Hello there and welcome to I'm All Over the Place. I am Dara Starr Tucker. I want to remind you that if you want to support the podcast, you can do that on Patreon, patreon.com/Dara Starr Tucker. That's one of the best ways that you can make sure that you continue to get these weekly episodes of I'm All Over the Place. I feel like the episodes I've done over the last few weeks have really represented a high watermark. These are the types of episodes that I strive to bring you all. Information-packed, power-packed, no time wasted, hard-hitting episodes about things that affect all of us. And if you want consistent content on things like what we're talking about this week, medical racism, what we talked about last week, white grievance politics, before that, an episode on voting rights, and before that, Project 2025, and on and on and on, the best way that you can ensure that you continue to receive substantive content like this on a weekly basis from me is to lend your support through Patreon. For those of you who are already patrons, thank you so much for your support. I could not do this work without you. I also want to remind you that we have a merch store on the DaraStarTucker.com website. I have breakdown merch for you, mugs, tumblers, t-shirts. Pick something up and rep the breakdown. If you want I'm All Over the Place specific merch, let me know and we'll put some of that on the website as well. But as I tell you every week, it helps if you rate the podcast, leave us a review. It helps us in the rankings. We want to get the podcast before as many ears as possible. So without further ado, here is the episode on medical racism. And of course, this is a part of the series that I am doing for my radio show on KJLH in Los Angeles. You all are going to hear an extended cut of that episode. So there's lots of content here that the radio audience will not be hearing. So for my I'm All Over the Place audience, here's the episode on medical racism coming up now. Well, hi there, folks. I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. I'm glad to be back here with you on KJLH to talk about the issues that matter. Let me tell you where you can connect with me. You can find me on the KJLH Instagram page. That's Radio Free KJLH, or you can find me on my personal Instagram page at Dara Tucker B. You can find me everywhere else at Dara Starr Tucker. That's Dara with one R and Star with two. I have really cool news for you today. I just found out that I'm going to be a part of your upcoming women's conference through KJLH. We're still working on the details. We don't know quite what shape this is going to take, but we are cooking up something for you that I think you're really going to enjoy. So I'm really excited about the opportunity to get to meet some of you face to face and hopefully have some really good interactions, maybe chop it up a bit with you about some of the things that we are working through here on The Breakdown. So stay tuned for that. I should have more information about it really soon, but I'm super looking forward to being there live with you and in person very, very shortly. That's happening in May. Now, what do we have coming up on today's show? Well, I have been wanting to do this for a long time. We are doing a deep dive today on medical racism. And this is kind of a tough one for me to talk about because, first of all, there are so many layers to this subject. It just sort of spider veins out and it goes in a lot of directions. And sometimes it can be a little bit difficult to get your head around the totality of it all. But also with me not being a medical professional, I'm always careful about not wanting to dive too deeply and get out of my depth and start talking about things that I'm not really qualified to discuss. You all know I believe in being well-researched, so it just has taken some time for me to really sink my teeth into the subject so I can present some hopefully cohesive information for those of you who are wanting a bit of a primer in this topic. But I think the question that we really have to start out with is, what is medical racism? Well, medical racism can take on a few different forms. It can relate to decisions that are being made by medical staff on your behalf, people that don't have your best interest at heart because they themselves are racist. It can involve not being listened to because someone is dismissive of you because they don't value you as much as they value someone of another race. It can involve testing, as we're going to hear in one of the breakdowns that I have for you. It can involve testing that's inherently racist and yields false results for Black people or brown people. It may involve the inherent biases of people on boards and committees and in laboratories and testing centers that are making decisions for you and about your health that enter into those spaces with their own confirmation biases. They're making those decisions to your detriment, and maybe they don't even realize that they are as detrimental as they are to people of color. And in more cases than what we may realize, it may involve literally the physical difference of being a Black person and the inability of healthcare workers to see changes in things like pigment and bruising or assumptions about racial groupings, how Black people experience pain, what our racial grouping makes us prone to in terms of health risks. If a medical professional has ignorance in that area, then it can be costly to us as Black people. If a medical professional is making assumptions about your health as a Black person that turn out to not be scientifically based, that can have a detrimental impact on your health. So medical racism can take a lot of forms. And Black people are at a higher risk for nearly every marker for disease and death, almost universally in the United States. So much so that the Centers for Disease Control declared in 2022 that racism is a threat to public health. And there are a lot of factors that go into why this is the case, why Black people in general tend to suffer with very poor health when compared particularly to white and Asian people. Indigenous people and Alaskan natives also tend to suffer with very poor health in comparison to white and Asian people. Hispanic people generally fall somewhere in between, and in some cases, their markers are actually very close to what white patients' markers are. So I'm speaking specifically about Black people because this is an issue that affects Black people disproportionately as compared with other racial groups. And as we know, the whole idea of racial groupings is a social construct. It is not a biological reality, but that doesn't make race-based discrimination in the medical field any less real. And how do we know that race-based discrimination is real? Well, in 2016, there was a study through the University of Virginia where 200 white medical students were questioned about race specifically. And some very interesting revelations came from that study. First of all, most of them assumed that Black people had a higher tolerance for pain than white people. And 40% of them actually thought that Black skin was tougher than white skin. And we're not talking metaphorical or theoretical. We're talking about Black people's literal skin. They assumed that it was of a tougher texture than white people's skin. This is 200 medical students in the year of our Lord 2016 who truly thought this, and many still do, I'm sure. So there is just the tendency on the part of a lot of folks in the medical profession to assume that Black people don't suffer in the way that other racial groups suffer. So as you can imagine, that means that a lot of our pain is minimized or ignored altogether. Black people tend to receive much lower quality care than white people do in the same medical settings. Life expectancies for Black people tend to be 20 to 25 years lower than white people. That is an enormous life expectancy gap. Our rates of high blood pressure, kidney disease, diabetes, stroke, heart disease, you name it, they are all higher than any other racial grouping. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And of course, behavioral issues come into play as well. But because of a lot of pseudoscience and eugenics, which is still with us, I think medical professionals have been all too eager to attribute much of this to inherent tendencies towards certain illnesses. But as I'm going to talk about in a breakdown that I have coming up for you, the idea that there are inherent biological differences between the races is false. So what are the reasons that the health and life expectancy of Black people tends to be so much lower than white people and pretty much every other racial group? Well, for starters, to say that Black America's relationship with the medical field is fraught with distrust and harm would be putting it lightly. We've all heard of things like the Tuskegee experiments, where men who had syphilis were promised that they would be receiving drug treatments that they were never given. And they were allowed to languish and suffer and die while being lied to by the medical community and being told that they were being treated for something that they were not being treated for. They were essentially treated like lab rats. And many of you may have heard of a woman named Henrietta Lacks. Oprah did a movie on her life a few years ago that not a lot of people saw. It might have been for HBO, but if you have the opportunity to see that movie, I would highly recommend it. It's very sad, but it's very well done. Now, if you don't know who Henrietta Lacks is, she was a Black woman whose cells were used in cancer research without her knowledge and without the knowledge of her children. She was a woman in the early 1950s who went to Johns Hopkins Hospital to be treated for cervical cancer. And because Johns Hopkins is a research hospital, they would regularly take samples of the cells of cancer patients and use them in their testing. Most of the cancer cells that they took from other patients would die pretty quickly in the lab, but Henrietta Lacks's cells were different because they were doubling every 20 to 24 hours, which was unlike anything they had ever seen. So it made these cells really effective in the research that these doctors were conducting at Johns Hopkins. So they essentially took the cells of Henrietta Lacks and called them HeLa cells. You may have heard of HeLa cells. That stands for Henrietta Lacks, the first two letters of her first and last name. So they took these HeLa cells and they used those infinitely multiplying cells to study the effects of toxins, of drugs, hormones, and viruses on the growth of cancer cells without having to experiment on human beings. Those HeLa cells have been used to test the effects of of radiations and poisons, and to study the human genome to learn more about how viruses work, HeLa cells played a huge role in the development of polio vaccines and the COVID-19 vaccine. So Henrietta Lacks ultimately died of cancer not too long after she started receiving treatment, but her cells have lived on and have been heavily used in medical research. They've been shared all over the world and have been used by researchers to do lots of good work. But she was never informed of what her cells were being used for, and her family wasn't either. So it was a massive violation. And of course, they had no laws against this back then. We have laws now that do a much better job at protecting research subjects, but those laws did not exist then. And she never benefited from the use of her cells, and neither did her family. Johns Hopkins University says that they never made a profit and they don't sell the HeLa cells. They just share them with other universities and researchers. But this was all done without the knowledge of her family and without compensating them in any way. So this is yet another example of how Black people have endured a very public violation at the hands of the medical community. So there is a deep fundamental distrust of the healthcare system with a lot of Black folks. And many of us have our own reasons for distrusting the healthcare system. But it's important to approach any conversation about medical care in the Black community with an understanding that these issues do exist and they don't exist within a vacuum. We know that Black people were dying at a much higher rate from COVID-19 because so many Black folks distrusted the vaccine. So they just didn't get it. And COVID-19 was so much more deadly for us than it was for any other group. Over 200 Black people die prematurely every day in the United States. And that's after living with illnesses at a much higher rate than any other racial group. And one group that's particularly susceptible to higher rates of medical complications and death is pregnant women. Maternal mortality rates in the Black community are astronomically high. Maternal mortality rates in the United States are already high, but for Black women, they're much, much higher than they are for anyone else. And why is that? Well, I talked about that in a recent breakdown that I'm going to play for you right now on maternal mortality rates. Many people don't realize how extreme this issue is, but I assure you, this is at crisis level. So I'm going to play this breakdown that I did for you right now, and I'm going to come back and we're going to talk about some of the underlying issues that are at play that are causing some of these disparities. Here's the breakdown that I did on maternal mortality rates. Take a listen. The 4x100 meters women's race at the 2016 Olympics in Rio was electrifying. Here were four Black women at the top of their game, winning gold for the United States. And running the anchor leg was Tori Bowie, a 25-year-old who would win the bronze, silver, and gold medals that year. But sadly, by April 2023, at only 32 years old, she would die giving birth alone in her home. And though there were mitigating mental health circumstances that impacted the health crisis that ultimately led to Tori's death, statistically speaking, she was already much more likely to die in childbirth than her white counterparts. In the U.S., a country with skyrocketing maternal mortality rates, Black women are 3 to 4 times as likely to die in childbirth as white women. As a matter of fact, of the four women who won gold in the 4x100 relay that day, Tiana Bartoletta, Allison Felix, English Gardner, and Tori Bowie, three of them would go on to suffer life-threatening health issues during pregnancy and childbirth. And for Tori, those complications would end up costing her her life. I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. If you've ever been in a room with a group of Black women discussing their pregnancy and childbirth experiences, you'll start to notice something. More than a fair number of them seem to have these shocking stories of terrible complications while having children. I know my mother did. As soon as my sisters and friends started having children, I started hearing those familiar accounts from them again and again. Gestational diabetes, high blood pressure, preterm labor, increased depression and anxiety, and on and on and on. And this is the case regardless of a woman's socioeconomic status. Beyonce recently revealed that she developed a condition during her pregnancy with her twins called preeclampsia. Because of this, one of her twins started showing signs of distress in the womb, and she ended up having to undergo an emergency C-section. Preeclampsia is a complication that can happen during pregnancy that causes high blood pressure or high levels of protein in your urine that can be a sign of damaged kidneys or other organs. If preeclampsia is untreated, it can lead to the death of both the mother and the baby. Though preeclampsia affects only 5 to 8% of all pregnancies, Black women are 60% more likely to develop this dangerous complication than white women. When these disturbing statistics are cited, Black women are often told that they need to learn to speak up for themselves. You have to be your own best advocate. But even when we are, we're less likely to be believed. Consider tennis star Serena Williams' experience. She suffered a pulmonary embolism, which is a life-threatening blood clot in the lungs, immediately after delivering her daughter Olympia in 2017. Since she had dealt with the condition before, she knew what the symptoms were. She said her legs were numb and she couldn't move them, or her back. After a series of complications that led to a surgery, she said she felt like she was dying. She begged the nurse to ask the doctor for a bilateral CAT scan of her lungs and to be put on a heparin drip. The nurse dismissed her and said that she was talking crazy because of all the medication she was on and that she just needed to rest. It was only because of Serena's persistence that her doctors finally performed that CAT scan, where they located a blood clot in her lungs. It was only a matter of time before it would have made its way to her heart. When you hear reporting on this issue, all too often they make it sound as though Black women's bodies are just built differently. Like it's just a biological reality that Black women will suffer more pregnancy and childbirth complications, and they just need to be aware to be on the lookout for it. But that's not really what's going on here. You would think that factors like educational disparities might play a role in these staggering statistics, and they do to a degree, but even a Black woman with a college degree is at a higher risk of death during pregnancy than a white woman who has not graduated high school. So why is it like this, and what can be done about it? Well, there are no easy answers on either of those fronts, unfortunately, but these troubling statistics are starting to be taken more seriously, and public awareness of these astronomically high Black maternal mortality rates is starting to increase. Public health officials think that there are a lot of factors at play, not the least of which is something called medical racism. This can include societal factors that make Black people less healthy, the tendency for Black people to be excluded from health insurance coverage, and implicit bias within the medical industry. Societal factors include things like homelessness or housing insecurity, environmental racism, which means Black people are more likely to develop illnesses like asthma because high polluting industries tend to be closer to their neighborhoods. Stress is also a societal factor. Black people are more likely to deal with toxic stress, which can lead to high blood pressure. Black people are also more likely than their white counterparts to be uninsured. And when attacks are made on reproductive healthcare facilities, Black women will suffer more than any other group. Maternal mortality rates doubled in just 2 years after Texas eliminated Planned Parenthood clinics and drastically cut the budgets for reproductive health clinics. And then there's perhaps the most important factor, healthcare professionals themselves. As in the case of Serena Williams, Black people often deal with something called bedside racism. Doctors are less likely to listen to Black women. They're more likely to assume that Black women have a higher pain tolerance, and Black women are more likely to be impacted by the legacy of outdated eugenics theories and pseudoscience that are baked into the medical profession. Like the spirometer, for instance. It's an instrument that's used to measure lung capacity. There's something called a race correlation built into the software of this apparatus that assumes that Black people have 20% less lung capacity than white people do. That's a theory that a pro-slavery doctor came up with way back in 1851, but we're still using it. So many examples of similar racist practices like that exist in the healthcare industry, and they all present a clear and present danger to Black women in pregnancy and childbirth. Now, the Black Maternal Health Caucus has specific legislative goals that it's pushing to stave off the disproportionate impact of preeclampsia on Black women that involve better use of remote technologies to reach more low-income and rural women, and better treatment for the mental health issues that Black women are more likely to suffer from. They're also putting pressure on the FDA to facilitate the development of better biomarkers to test for preeclampsia that will allow doctors to test for the illness with diagnostic tools that go beyond urine tests and blood pressure monitoring. The fact that the United States has the highest maternal mortality rate of any Western nation is reason enough for alarm, but the disproportionate effect that that troubling reality has on Black women should be reason enough to declare it a national health crisis. The Centers for Disease Control have designated the week of April 11th through the 17th as Black Maternal Health Week. I didn't know that when I started putting this together. The timing is quite fortuitous, but I'm happy to be drawing attention to an issue that has remained on the sidelines of our public health conversations for far too long. It's my hope that as we begin to take this issue more seriously, stories like Tori Bowie's will become exceedingly rare. It's also my hope that anyone referring to themselves as pro-life would deeply consider that stance in its totality and move the issue of maternal mortality to the top of their list of priorities. So why do these disparities exist in the Black community where our health is concerned? Well, a lot of factors are at play here. Poverty is a big one. Lack of access to affordable housing, poor education in many places. And education, as I said in that breakdown, can be a factor. Although even accounting for education differentials, we still suffer maternal mortality rates at a higher level than anyone else. But the emphasis on health and wellness in our community is definitely another factor. Diet and exercise definitely contribute to this. But it's difficult to talk about issues around around diet and exercise when many Black people live in food deserts. If you don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables or high quality food, your health is going to suffer. If you don't have access to adequate employment opportunities, your health is going to suffer. Adequate employment improves health. Improving the living conditions of people always improves their health. If you're living in a low-income area, you're more likely to be living near pollutants that lower the quality of your air and that lower the quality of your water. We all know about Flint, Michigan, and Jackson, Mississippi, and Lake Charles, Louisiana, three examples where environmental racism has had a major impact on Black communities. And of course, this is going to impact the health of those people. But I think a few of the factors that we don't hear discussed enough are stress, which Black people are much more prone to endure because of issues like poverty and lack of employment opportunities and housing insecurity, and then racism. Not only the stress that Black people are enduring because of racism, but the impact of racism itself. Racism can have what is known as a weathering effect. Now, what's a weathering effect? It's the impact of a certain action on an object or a person over a period of time. So imagine a water faucet drip, drip, dripping, and it just keeps hitting one spot over and over and over again and eroding the paint or eroding the porcelain or the enamel or whatever, or like water on a rock. It just erodes that rock over hundreds of thousands of years. That's the effect that racism can have on Black people's minds and on their bodies. If you're dealing with the effects of racism on a daily basis, there is a chronic wear and tear on your body, and that can lead to sickness and disease. That is the weathering effect. And to add to that, community hospitals in Black neighborhoods tend to be very much underfunded. And there's an historical factor here that a lot of people may not actually be aware of. It dates all the way back to 1910, back when you had something called the Flexner Report on Medical Education. And this was a report that was commissioned by the Carnegie Foundation. It was actually the catalyst for five of the seven Black medical schools that existed at the time being closed down permanently. Now, this report concluded that of the seven medical schools that existed to educate Black people that were around at that time, only two of them were worth salvaging. Abraham Flexner, who wrote this report, claimed that five of the medical schools that existed in 1910 were churning out low-quality students, and he recommended that they be shuttered. The only two Black institutions that were training Black doctors at the time, who of course were not allowed to attend white institutions, were Howard University Medical School and Meharry Medical College in Nashville. So he recommended closing Leonard Medical School in Raleigh, North Carolina, along with four other schools that were educating Black doctors. And this had a devastating impact on the Black community, not only in the ability of Black patients to find adequate health care, but it's estimated that these schools that were shuttered could have educated an additional 30,000 to 35,000 Black doctors. And I'm going to let you hear a little bit of the racist language that was used in this Flexner report that completely decimated the Black medical educational system a little over 100 years ago. These are the words of Dr. Flexner. He says, quote, "The medical care of the Negro race will never be wholly left to Negro physicians, and Negroes must be educated not only for his sake, and the Negro must be educated not only for his sake, but for ours. The Negro is perhaps more easily taken in than the white, and as his means of extricating himself from a blunder are limited, it is all the more cruel to abuse his ignorance through any sort of pretense. Make-believe in the matter of the Negro schools is therefore intolerable." And it just goes on and on like that. So clearly, Dr. Flexner did not see a lot of value in educating a large swath of the Black population to go into the medical field. And the Black community has paid enormously for this decision since then. Now, I want to play for you a second breakdown that I did on this topic that specifically deals with testing and evaluation. I did a breakdown on how the whole policy around kidney disease is assessed and the impact that racialized assumptions have had on that field. So I'm going to play that breakdown for you right now, and I'll be back with some closing thoughts. Racism in the medical profession has been killing Black people for centuries. Let's take kidney or renal failure, for example. Black people are four times as likely to suffer from renal failure as white people are. But we're often diagnosed much later than other racial groups, and it takes much longer for us to get on transplant lists. Why is that, you ask? Because the actual test to determine kidney function is racist. I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. Now, it may sound strange to call a test racist, but it's 100% true. And the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network Board just outlawed the test completely. And not only did they outlaw the test, but they also recalculated the wait times for all Black kidney transplant candidates and had to move a bunch of them to the front of the line because the severity of their renal failure had been grossly underestimated. It's kind of an unprecedented move by a medical board to enact restorative justice where clear medical racism was at play. Now, how does this happen? How do you develop a racist kidney failure test? Well, about 20 years ago, researchers finally developed a fairly reliable test for evaluating kidney function called EGFR. The test evaluates how efficiently a person's kidneys move a waste product called creatinine from the blood. They noticed that the study participants who were black had higher levels of creatinine in their blood, even when their kidney function was operating at the same level as their white counterparts. The conclusion they drew was that those black participants had more muscle mass, since people with higher muscle mass make more creatinine. Now, testing creatinine levels is not a perfect indicator of kidney function. All kinds of things can affect creatinine levels. But instead of considering that other factors like medications or dietary differences might have affected the creatinine levels of those black research study participants, they made the assumption that black people just naturally have more muscle mass than white people because their creatinine levels were higher. This is largely based upon the false belief that there are biological differences between the races. If you believe that, as many medical professionals still do, then you're likely to believe the false assumption that black people are just naturally more muscular than other so-called races. So there was a racial differential that was built into the test along with age and sex. If you were black, your kidney function was just assumed to be naturally higher than it really was. And this race correlation has been used for over 20 years because the majority of the medical community wasn't questioning the assumptions that researchers were making about black people's bodies. It's estimated that the test made black people appear to have kidney function that was 16% higher than it actually was, which means that for 20 years, black people have been diagnosed with kidney failure at much lower rates than what they should have been, and they've been told that they didn't qualify for a kidney transplant even when their kidney function was at an identical level to a white person's. Human genome studies have shown that there are no inherent biological differences between the so-called races, but many black people have suffered and died because this racist practice was just baked into the medical system. When we talk about systemic racism, this is what we mean. Institutions are often set up to devalue, dismiss, and deprioritize black people, not because you have hood-wearing Klansmen or neo-Nazi skinheads at the helm, but because you have a handful of well-meaning researchers unaware of their implicit biases who are unconsciously applying their assumptions about race to their work in a way that has proven detrimental to black people. The Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network just approved eliminating this race-based calculation in 2022, and in 2023, they required that kidney transplant programs reassess their lists and make the necessary adjustments to reprioritize any black patients who were disadvantaged by the racist test. Their Minority Affairs Committee, led by Dr. Nwamaka Ininya, is leading the charge to come up with a more equitable equation going forward. This is truly an unprecedented move by a major medical body to acknowledge wrongdoing and to take steps to alter its course. Let's hope that this decision sets a precedent going forward for the medical community at large. So it feels good to be able to talk about what is very much a step forward in a long history of racist practices in the medical field. If you're anything like me, you're probably thinking, yeah, but what about all the people who were overlooked during that 20-year time span? When I hear the term restorative justice, I'm really wondering what has been done or could be done to compensate the families of those people who died waiting for kidneys who were overlooked because of those racist practices. But we take our wins where we can. And as I mentioned in the other breakdown, a similar situation happened with a spirometer that evaluates lung capacity. These assumptions that black people's biology is somehow fundamentally different from everyone else's can lead to very dire consequences for us. This is an ongoing issue. The story has not finished being written, but I truly do believe that things are getting better. Now, it doesn't mean that we're not still dealing with opposition, but I think more and more people in the medical community are starting to wake up to the fact that these practices have had a detrimental impact on black communities. But I think racism within the medical community is something that should be called out again and again. And as with a lot of forms of racism, it's going to take, first of all, people of good conscience to say, hey, something needs to change. But it's also going to take an intentional diversification of not only doctors and researchers, but of administrators and academics and other decision makers who can provide a different perspective. It's not enough to claim colorblindness. When you're dealing with people's health and you're not aware of your own internal biases, those biases can kill. as we've seen time and time again. This is not an issue that's going to be handled easily or quickly, but addressing the disparities in healthcare from all angles, improving housing access, education, living conditions, environmental factors, and training medical professionals to listen to Black people and to take our pain seriously, eliminating food deserts, improving employment opportunities, all of these factors work together to improve the health profile of Black folks here in this country. Well, that's my time. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of The Breakdown on Medical Racism. I really do enjoy getting to talk to you all about topics like this. It's a big one. And as we know, there are no easy answers, but we're seeing the needle moving forward just a bit in our lifetime. And we're going to do what we can to help that process along. You all make sure to have your yearly checkups, okay? Get your blood work done, get your pressure checked, get your yearly exams, okay? I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this has been The Breakdown. Join me again next week, same time, same place, to talk about the issues that matter. I'll see you next time, and until then, let's learn to shout.